Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
We're back with The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Back in May, writer, actor, director, and comedian Bashir Salahuddin stopped by The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Now, the appearance was a bit of a reunion. Earlier in his career, Bashir had been a writer for Fallon, but he didn't return to the writer's room. He took a seat on the guest couch, fresh off his star turn in the blockbuster hit, Top Gun Maverick.
Did you guys bond? Like, you and Tom Cruise?
Oh, man, he just texted me yesterday, just because we had a screening issue. I feel like I'm bragging, and it's not even, I'm just telling the...
Now, this disarming little humble brag just might be a Bashir specialty, as I quickly learned when I sat down with him earlier this week. A Harvard graduate who started off college as a pre-med major, I teasingly asked if he'd become a comedian after failing organic chemistry.
You know, as the old folks say, a lie is all the way around the world before the truth gets out of bed. No, organic chemistry was one of my best grades in pre-med.
Oh, okay. Slight flex.
Let's clear that up right now. Your boy understands valence. Let's get it going. No, the class I almost failed was college physics. That kicked my butt.
Oh, I see. Organic chemistry was a breeze. It was just that Harvard physics that provided a challenge. Well played and revealing. As an accomplished comedy writer and showrunner, there wasn't any doubt Bashir was funny, but he just let me know he was smart and charming as well. Smart, funny, and charming also describes Salahuddin's body of work. Along with comedy partner Diallo Riddle, he's co-creator and co-star of Sherman's Showcase. It's a variety show with a 1970s citational vibe, wholly familiar and genuinely original.
Hello, and welcome to Brother, You Wrong.
Hold up, Brother, You're Wrong. Now, this is my show, and I should open the discussion.
Brother, You Wrong. That's mad territorial of you to be like, this is my show. This is our show.
Brother, You Wrong for assuming that I wasn't going to show love to the table.
Hold up.
Then there's his HBO sitcom, Southside, set in his hometown, Chicago.
Check him out. If the word shady was in the dictionary, this dude's picture would be next to it.
Shady is in the dictionary.
Half the people who shop here are shady. I just helped a guy wearing jeans on top of jeans get some office chairs.
Oh, damn, that's Fred. He doing that jean on jean again? Fuego!
Southside delivers, as one member of Team Takeaway described it, rib-breaking laughs. It isn't just hilarious, it's accurate. Propelled by an affectionate authenticity derived from growing up on the South Side, Bashir truly sees, hears, and feels the people who are characters in the show. But the comedic cultural gifts that are Sherman's Showcase and Southside almost never came into being. After all, Bashir is a smart kid from a striving, working-class Black family.
I do feel like the fact that I was able to, you know, get into Harvard, you know, it's important how you utilize such a great opportunity, and certainly going into the arts was really not on the list of accepted inner city kid careers who got into Harvard. Eventually, I had to call my dad and say, look, like, I don't think I'm a doctor. I think I want to play a doctor. So, you know, yeah, it definitely is like, if you get a chance to go to a school like that, are you going to go into the arts, which is very, very, I would say almost higher than zero, but a very low guarantee of being able to actually do better than your parents did. But I think in our community, personal fulfillment feels like the more you seek it, especially if you aren't really taking care of yourself and your people, then you are being selfish and you are really not building on all the work that the people before you had to do. You could even have an opportunity to go to a school like that. You know, as an artist, it's tough. And I'll say that even goes beyond race. It even goes beyond economic status. No matter who you are, if you choose to go into the arts, there is that moment of like, you understand this could all just fail. I mean, it could all come crashing down. It's not easy. There's a lot of rejection. But for me, well, there were two reasons that I ended up having to stay true to it and having to sort of have this revelation with my parents. And the beautiful thing was, again, my dad said at the time, he was like, you know, I think we always knew you were an actor. And so this is like not really surprising. And I was like, okay, good. I'm glad I was communicating that. You know, I do feel like I looked up and I was like, man, you call yourself pre-med, but all you do with all your free time is theater. You can't get enough theater or spoken word plays or, you know, whatever. I was writing plays undergraduate. I was reading other people's work. I was so immersed in it. And I'm very fortunate that, you know, at least being from where I'm from, I did have a certain modicum of toughness, and I did feel like, you know, I was ready to take that journey, and I knew the journey was not going to be easy, but I do think it kind of worked out.
I love as you were telling that story, there were all these other parts that I kept hearing. There's a kind of generational piece, right? So you got a little bit of that kind of Gen X notion of like, yeah, it matters, you know, what you love, but also, you know, you owe something to folks. There's also a lot of that like first gen immigrant kids story there. And I know that your dad is, so you are real Chicago in so many ways. And your dad is from Panama.
He's from Panama. Yeah, they all came to Chicago when he was like, I don't know how old he was. Because, you know, here's the problem with some of our oral history. It's real inconsistent from relative to relative. And this is the true thing about Black people. You know, they were over there in Panama not making it, right? And of course, there was always that yearning. We got to have a better life. We got to do right by these kids. And my granddad had six kids. And so he came over first, and then he labored, and then he had enough money and enough whatever to finally get my grandmother, and, you know, didn't really speak any English. And then they went right to the South Side of Chicago. And, you know, the South Side of Chicago got jokes. So here come these people with these weird accents speaking this weird language. And, you know, they got, you know, they kind of, they had to get their lumps in, but, you know, to their credit, they figured it out, and they really did become Chicagoans. And I've sort of begun really trying to more so embrace that side of my history, because it's not something, you know, when I was growing up in Chicago, there wasn't any like it wasn't until I went to college on the East Coast that I learned that, oh, there's not just Black people. There's Haitians, right, and Bermudians.
You're
and
like, Bahamians, right, you're like, we're just Black.
Asians.
Yeah.
Chicago is you Black, right? You Black. And then it wasn't like I had friends. I was like, what, you Haitian? We went to high school for 3 years. I never knew that. He was like, yeah, man. So, you know, it's not until you really get to these, in some ways, the East Coast schools, where you have all these wonderful groups, like the, you know, they have these Caribbean societies and the, you know, the West African club and all this stuff, that you really like to learn a little bit more about where in the diaspora some of your folks came from. And so for me, again, in Chicago, it was like I was Black. But then after a while, I began to realize, you know what, there's so much richness, not just genetically, but also, you know, culturally with regard to food and things and what my dad would make for us growing up. That I want to embrace and I want to know more about. And so I really began to explore Panama more as I got older.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with the humor and heart of Bashir Salahuddin in just a moment. It's The Takeaway.
On the media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back and talking with writer, director, actor, and comedian Bashir Salahuddin. Now, it was supposed to be a conversation about his work, but let's get real. We spent most of our time talking about his hometown, Chicago. Good thing that his wildly successful and much beloved HBO sitcom, South Side, is also all about Chicago.
Well, South Side is a half-hour comedy. It's based in and around the South Side of Chicago, where I'm from. And it comes from a lot of different places, but where it really primarily comes from is two places. It comes from both my brother Sultan identifying, you know, having known that my writing partner and I were looking for a show to do that was based on one of our hometowns. My brother identified this place, Rent-A-Center, as potentially having being a great location to do a show around. And so we went to this Rent-A-Center place where you rent furniture and appliances, and if you don't pay, they come get it from you. It's really very pervasive in low-income communities, but it's also how low-income folks have TVs and video game systems and enjoy the stuff that they see other people doing. And what we found you know, is that because the store requires you as an employee to drive around the city, that it allowed for us to tell a story and have a TV show in which the characters were forced by virtue of their jobs to be in and around the city of Chicago. And so we thought that was quite beautiful that we could not only do a show about some blue collar folks, but also a show that really showed off the city and really got to know the South Side. So that's one place it comes from. The other place it really comes from is, you know, me and my writing partner, Diallo, our desire to just do like a really great comedy. Part of the reason we wanted to do that is because Chicago was so maligned. You know, I would hear about my hometown in the news and I'd be like, I don't know what city they're talking about. Like, don't get it wrong. There's definitely challenges, but the vast majority of folks, especially Black folk on the South Side, they're chill, they're funny. They got jokes, they're gonna talk about you. You know, one of my buddies is want to say, if you go in somebody's house on the South Side Thanksgiving, you're gonna come out family. Chicago people are very loving and they're really funny. And that's another thing is that the South Side was really never given its props for the comedians like Robin Harris and Adele Givens, who's on the show this season, and all these really great funny voices, because Chicago comedy, and you know, we love the North Side, but so much of Chicago comedy was centered on, you know, your Highland Parks, your Ferris Bueller's, your Breakfast Clubs, your Blues Brothers. These are things that are mostly downtown North Side things. And so, again, it was almost like, hey, it's not just the North Side that's funny. The whole city has so much to offer comedically. And it's such a much more comedy forward place. And I got to tell you, you know, when we shoot the show, you know, the people who pass on the street, everybody, they love it. They're happy. And to a person, 100% of them are sure that the only thing our show is missing is them. And, you know, right. A lot of people, they'd be like, hey, man, why you playing, bro? You know, you got to get me in the scene, man. Come on. I'm like, and we do that sometimes. You'll actually see in the first episode of season three, there's a dude who was a snow cone vendor in my neighborhood. And I just went to buy snow cones one day and he made me laugh. And he's on the show. We're at a point now when we're shooting, people yelling out of car windows and, oh, they shoot Southside, you know, and it's like, there's a sense that we have been welcome. There's a sense that people like what we're doing. And that means a lot.
Let's talk about Sherman's Showcase, which still has a lot of, I mean, you know, which is your comedy, but is real also real different than Southside.
Yes.
And it also, again, kind of pointing to the generational, Sherman's Showcase feels more like, oh yeah, I know what this is. I recognize this as a kid born in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. You know, for each of our projects, and I want to really give him credit, either my writing partner or I will sort of become the captain of that project, right? We found that we're a partnership, but at the end of the day, somebody has to steer the ship. And so for Sherman's Showcase, that person is Diallo Riddle. And he also plays Dutch on the show. We wanted to do a sketch comedy show. We knew we wanted to do a sketch comedy show because that's how we got started. We got started in sketch. We got started. And there was a sense of frustration that we weren't really doing what we wanted to do. So we began to write for ourselves. We began to work together. We put together a sketch comedy troupe called Cleo's Apartment. That's actually how we ended up getting on Jimmy Fallon's radar. Ended up writing for him for 4 years. We wrote before his show started, through the first 4 years. We were part of that core writing team. But eventually, you know, we knew we wanted to do our own sketch comedy show. You know, as a writer, you go, look, I love to be able to help somebody else's vision. And at some point, you know, we want to create our own. And so we realized we were doing some like doo-wop sketch at one point. And we really, with Jimmy, and I think that's when we realized like, hey, this feels like what our show should be. This feels like the form. And so we picked kind of a 70s variety show form that obviously Soul Train is a huge influence, but there's also American Bandstand. There's also Bert Sugarman's Midnight Special. You know, there's all these other, like at some point in the 70s, everybody and their mama had a variety show. Like they were just giving them out like hotcakes. We knew by doing a variety show that it allegedly or pretended to span decades, it would allow us to do comedy from the past, the present, and the future. And part of that, again, is the writers collectively having like probably combined 40, 50 years in comedy, right? So we're just like, how do we continue to both service the basic form, which is just doing a funny sketch comedy show, but also service our experience, which says we're experienced enough that we can put a little more energy into this and figure out a truly unique, you know, comedy delivery system, right? And the comedy delivery system was a variety show in which I play the host, kind of unhinged, completely inconsistent, politically all over the map, has no loyalty, is self-interested. I really based him a lot on Krusty the Clown. Like he's one of my favorite characters because It wasn't until I got to Hollywood that I was like, man, Krusty is like the most accurate representation of Hollywood in the world. All he cares about is the next day's ratings. And I was like, that's literally how it is sometimes.
I think sometimes the, you know, the question that gets asked is like, so what's your advice, you know, for young folks? And I want to ask it slightly differently because of the framework you gave me of, you know, doing this work, having these extraordinary opportunities, doing this work in terms of making someone else's vision come true, and then ultimately moving into making your own vision real. Can you talk to the young creators out there, whether they're in news production or whether they're in comedy, but they're artists, they're writers, they're thinkers, about that transition and about how to maybe think about those different parts of the long career?
I think you just nailed it. I think you have to assume that you will have a long career. I mean, the reason I moved into mine was two parts. One part, I had a passion for it. And the other part of it was that people loved when I did it and wanted more from me. So I have memories even before I solidified, you know, my sense of wanting to go into the arts, of performing and getting, you know, plaudits and ovations and what have you. So it wasn't like I was like, well, there's no evidence that I'm good at this. It was like, no, there's tons of empirical evidence that this is something you maybe should be doing, you know. But everything is education. Everything has to be your education. I look at my failures as educational. And I, you know, one of our writers, for example, who wrote in our writer room on Southside is now writing in another room. But we were talking about it and they were like, yo, it sucks. And this dude is mad, terrible. I hate working for him. And I was like, look, that's all part of your education. You got to have people you love working with, and you got to have some jobs where you're like, this is terrible, because then it's all part of your education and you learn. And, you know, I always tell people that that's a very big part of a long career, is knowing that everything you do is contributive to that. And so there's always this impetus to do your own thing, but you can't, like, you got to be okay working for other folks sometimes, because there's so much to learn. But you won't get all this education if you don't go out and do stuff. And that's why I'm always telling people to just make stuff. I'm always telling young artists and writers, go make something. You know, people would much rather watch a short film than read a script. And I think also, and this is something I suffer from too, you know, it definitely feels like, you know, you're on a clock, especially if you come from circumstances like mine where your family doesn't have a lot of money. You know, you do feel like, this is taking too long, and what's going on? I'm getting older. I'm looking at 30 right now. I'm almost 30 and I still haven't really made a penny doing this stuff. Like I probably didn't make any money writing until I was like 29, 28, maybe 30. It took a long time. You know, and there was many, many, many years of, you know, busting my ass and making nothing. But all that stuff was contributive. All of it kind of helped. So that when it came time to seize my own opportunities, I was ready. I was like, yep, I know what to do now. And so all those little pieces, they add up. And eventually it'll be obvious to you, you know, the best way to proceed, to present your own work. And hopefully, and this is actually really crucial. And I really got this from Paula Vogel. She's a writer. Mm-hmm. She wrote up the Baltimore Waltz. And I was at the Hangar Theater and she came up to do an artist day with us. She just talked to us about being an artist. And she said the best advice she could give us was that circles rise together. And what she meant by that was, you know, the best way for you to advance and do more is to reach out laterally to your mm-hmm. peers, mm-hmm. not up to people who are, you know, who are more advanced in their careers, who are going to somehow pull you up. Doesn't work like that. If you look at George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, these guys are all friends. They're all broke. You know, they're all making movies together. The question I always ask is, who around you is as hungry as you are? Because that's who you need to be messing with.
That was Bashir Salahuddin, actor and co-creator of Southside on HBO Max and Sherman's Showcase on IFC.